Sometimes when I'm watching television, and I think that most of the people in the movie are probably dead, and it's spooky. And when I go to a funeral, see the people weeping, and a body in the casket. For the Friendly Ghost cartoon, I always wondered how it was, and he died, and it's spooky. Sometimes when I'm watching television.
That was a cover of It's Spooky by Daniel Johnston and Jad Fair, a true power couple. Speaking of power couples, today's guest and I are a power couple. Well, at least he helps me a lot. I have had an ongoing conversation with this man about Buddhism and meditation. I guess it's been going on over for many years now. And I love sharing him with all of y'all. You know him from the Midnight Gospel. It's David Nickturn. He is the principal instructor at dharmamoon.com. And he's also a good friend of mine and incredibly talented musician, among other things. And today, we had a really wild conversation about war, violence, secret mystery schools, the roots of Buddhism, Christianity, and Islam. And we even brought up the great mystery that hovers around anyone living today, which is the roots of the term okay. I hope you'll stay tuned. It's a great chat. But first, this. This episode of the DTFH has been brought to you by Super Speciosa, purveyors of the finest kratom on planet Earth. Kratom gets you in a really cool zone. It's a wild buzz. Kratom's been around for centuries. People have used it for all kinds of things, from relaxing to getting energy. It just makes you feel good. I don't know what the buzz is. The plant is related to the coffee plant, which is really curious because it sure doesn't feel like coffee. I like it though. It really helps me chill out at the end of the day, and it's just a wonderful, nice after work wind down herb. If you're a beginner at this stuff, order the capsules. Don't do the powder. They sent me powder. I'm not gonna use the powder. I'm afraid of the powder. I need it measured out for me. I like to be like a laboratory animal that doses itself. So I don't know about the powder. If you're an advanced Kratom user, then you know about the powder already. Order the powder. All I can tell you is this stuff is top-notch, high-grade, holy shit level Kratom. And I hope that you will give it a try. If you've heard about it, if you're interested in it, or if you're looking for a new Kratom source. Also, the folks over at Super Speciosa want to offer you 20% off. Go to superleaf.com/Duncan. You're going to get 20% off with promo code Duncan. That's getsuperleaf.com/Duncan. Use promo code Duncan for 20% off. And this code can be used again and again and again and again for people in the audience that have already used it. So there you go. Thank you, Super Speciosa. Send me more. And we are back. Friends, I want you to come see me do some stand-up comedy with Johnny Pemberton this weekend in Austin. The last time I was there attempting to do stand-up comedy, I was beset by the plague and had to spend 10 days in a hotel room. But I'm flying back to make it up to you for canceling all those shows. I hope you'll come out. It's at the Vulcan Gas Company. All the links are at DuncanTrussell.com. Also, to my sweet LA friends, I'm going to be there at the end of the month doing a live DTFH for the Netflix is a Joke Comedy Festival. Dan Harmon is going to be one of the guests on this episode, so it's going to be epic. You can find all these ticket links at duncantrussell.com. And finally, won't you join my Patreon? It's at patreon.com/DTFH. And now my dear sweeties with us here today is David from the Midnight Gospel, a.k.a. David Nickturn, a.k.a. Principal Meditation Teacher at dharmamoon.com. If you like him, check him out over there. Take one of his classes. They're offering a teacher training program in May and lots of other stuff. You can find it all at dharmamoon.com. But before you do that, tune in for this conversation with David Nickturn. Hello. Good to see you, David. How you doing?
Everything's okay, Duncan. But do you know what okay stands for?
No.
Well, neither do I.
Oh, my God. I've never considered that.
We say it all the time, right?
Okay.
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 Well, there's the O part and the K part.
Okay. Yeah. Holy shit. Wow.
I didn't mean to derail you completely.
This is just going to destroy my life. I've been saying that over and over. Never once have we thought to look it up. Is this the clue? Is it hidden in that? If we look up okay, suddenly it reveals our true reality?
Well, if we looked at it as mantra, you know, O is opening, right? And K is cutting.
Open and cut. Sounds like a scary mantra. But yeah, I get it. I mean, that's kind of revision, right? The opening part is the writing. Then the K part would be when you have to go in and actually work. You know, my favorite part of writing is the very initial vomiting out of some idea onto the page.
Right.
Everything after that, not quite as fun.
They call that writing down the bones.
Yeah,
have you heard that expression?
I have. Yeah, writing down the bones. And then that's when the real work kicks in. I think that's why a lot of people aren't like never become writers is because they don't want to go through. They like the bone part, but they don't like structuring the whatever it is they're working on. I don't. Most writers I know hate the revision part and the trimming part. How do you feel about that part of the process?
They like the O part, but they don't like the K.
They don't like the K. Yeah.
You know, this is, the creative process is so interesting that it dawns, you know, and it just kind of opens up.
Yes.
It comes out of space and gap and nothing in particular, right? Whenever you have a creative idea, it just seems to come from nowhere.
Yes.
And then you're right, the follow through is what separates the manifestors from the dreamers.
Yeah, exactly. Right, exactly. Because the dreamers, if you can stay dreamer, if you can stay the O part, then you can fool yourself into thinking that there's something, I don't know, soft about you, sweet about you. You know what I mean? Like that sure. You can trick yourself into it. But because anytime you see the people who are into the K part of stuff, there's this weird rugged quality to them or an oxen-like quality, you know, where they just, they keep, like, I've run into many people, you know, in living in LA, of course, you're surrounded by people who are good at both parts. Mm. But the second part, the first part is like riding around on your like fancy horse in front of some nice palace in some fantasy countryside. You know, it's a sort of like you feel like a poet or like the fool in the tarot card deck or whatever. The second part, it really is more like digging trenches or planting seeds or, you know what I mean? It's hard. It's hard work. And I think it turns a lot of people off.
Well, and then you can have too much K. There's not enough O.
Well, this is why they say write stoned, revise sober.
So it might be interesting to switch it around.
You can't, because if you get stoned and try to do revisions, and this is just not me. Yeah. I've talked to editors, like people, mm-hmm, and they have told me that they cannot edit And sorry for the editors out there, like, this is, I'm always stoned, but some editors I've talked to, they're like, I can't edit stoned, because not because it like incapacitates me, but because I become too, I zoom in too much on just the little bits of the thing. You can become like too into the little parts.
Yeah. Are you getting stoned a lot these days?
No, I haven't been as much, you know, I'm always like getting stoned here and there, but no, I go through phases with marijuana. I mean, my last big marijuana phase was years ago, and I stayed stoned for 2 years straight, but I haven't gone back there. It was fun. It was a fun 2 years. It was fun.
Yeah.
I was in best shape of my life.
You mean because you exercised a lot?
Yeah, because I liked, I had wrapped together getting stoned and jogging, which is one of the great experiences in life. Wow. Have you ever done, you've never done that?
Well, you know, I don't get stoned all that often.
But sometimes.
And I jog even less.
Okay. Well,
yeah. Maybe I'm missing that it's a couple. You know?
Oh my God. Yeah, that's of, like, I think that of all the substances out there that I'm aware of, marijuana is the best for exercise.
Wow. That's the first time I've ever even heard that.
Really? Yeah. That's wild. That's
what about eating and, you know, kind of spacing out and all, and listening to music and things like that?
You can do, well, I would eat while when I used to jog. I would carry a backpack full of
Oh, God. That's a formula for a potential disaster, isn't it?
Dogs. Yeah. The problem is dogs chase you. But the getting stoned and exercising, because, you know, marijuana is a very like earthy high. Mm. Like you're in your body. This is why a lot of people get paranoid, because they're like, it reminds you of all the earth stuff that you need to take care of. You know, whereas like other substances like ketamine, LSD, they're more ethereal. Mm-hmm, you know, you could say, I think you could say, argue that mushrooms are a very earthy high. Mm. Like they, but some things seem to not be earthy at all. They seem to be alien or sort of, you know, dissociatives in particular. Anyway, you should try it, David. I'm serious. You would like it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I practice Tai Chi and Qigong. That's my main, and I'm studying a sword form with the Tai Chi. That's very interesting.
Tai Chi is really cool. I took a Tai Chi class in college, and I just didn't understand it. But now I think about it sometimes, wondering what is going on there. Like, you see people doing it in the park and stuff, and it's like some form of dance, but also it's moving energy in a certain way. Or what's going on with that?
Yeah, it's got a knowledge of the inner landscape, the channels and energy channels. So it's the same knowledge as acupuncturists would have. Usually a good Tai Chi person can also do acupuncture. My teacher can do both. And energy just gets blocked in your body. You know, look at the way anybody's sitting at any one time. You can see almost an energy diagram around them of their physical energy.
Right.
So, but in terms of O and K, you know, I think that's, we stumble upon stuff, don't we, Duncan? You know, we just kind of like put on our goggles and go down.
Yeah.
But there is something about the allowing space, you know? And I saw your podcast the other night on BHN.
It was, oh, yeah.
And I was just thinking, you know, how many people just leave a little bit of space at all, even in a conversation or in their day?
Right.
You know, just, and that's, you know, it's just like, there's nothing to do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I think maybe, you know, people might think that drugs could enhance that. Do you think that some people would take drugs to enhance that sense of, and spaciousness and ease?
Yeah, sure. Definitely.
Yeah.
It's a tool to get there. It's one of the ways to get there. I mean, it's just one, you know, the problem with drugs that we haven't fixed yet, which I hope we will, is that it's like, balding medications. You want to take the balding medication? Guess what? Your dick's not going to get as hard, right? You know what I mean? So
wait a minute. What?
That could be one of the effects.
Maybe you're putting it in the wrong place.
It can fuck up your sex drive. So, like, you're putting it in the wrong place. What do you mean? You're not supposed to push it into your cock? Holy shit. I got to get more. No, like, this is the, so this is the trade-off, right? You, yeah. Certain types of MDMA, right? It makes you want to cuddle. It's like, makes sex great. But guess what? You can't come. So there are these like satanic things built into certain substances where there's either a price you have to pay that is not equal to the experience, but can sometimes exceed the experience in suffering. You know what I mean? Like MDMA, at least if you've done it as many times as I have, I don't take it anymore because the it's not worth the 2 days when my brain doesn't have enough happy juice in it and I go into a depression for a couple of days. So I can't do it anymore. And I know a lot of people who just, they just can't. And then to try to mitigate that, there's all sorts of things you can take after and before that might help you balance out a little bit, but it's just, to me, not worth it anymore. In the beginning, it was great, but now not so much. I'm down to only a few drugs that I can like take that don't have a repercussion, marijuana being one of them, at least as far as I can tell.
Do you think you could, what would be the consequence of you just stopping completely for a year?
Probably like I've become too productive.
You become too productive?
No.
Wow. But you're pretty productive already. What do you mean?
No, I'm just, I'm not really, I'm not a stoner anymore. I used to do it all the time. I mean, so that I don't know that there'd be any consequence, anything would really change that much.
You know, any habit is so interesting to shift. Any habit. So even I sometimes say, do this with your hands.
Okay.
And I just reverse the placement.
All right.
You feel that?
Yeah, it's totally different.
It's totally different. It's and it doesn't feel comfortable or normal.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. Right.
So resting in spaces that don't feel comfortable or normal is almost a good practice in itself.
Yeah. This was okay. So Crowley, in his book Liber 4, I believe it's in that book. This is the beginning phases of magic. He would recommend exactly this, except it was weird stuff like stop using your left hand for a month or, you know, don't say I for a month, you know, things like that. But then because it's Crowley, he added to it. And again, sorry for my Thelemites out there. He added to it, like that you punish yourself if you mess up. So like, you know, and he recommended, I think, like cutting yourself or like hurting yourself.
No.
Yeah. But it was, I think he was mirroring in India. And in fact, isn't this when the Buddha goes into the forest, he encounters the ascetics and the ascetics were doing stuff like this. They were not eating. They were, and in India you see people who have like out of some penance have put their hand up and won't lower. And so it just, you know, that thing. So this is, what you're talking about, what Crowley was talking about, it's like a way to shift out of your comfort zone.
Yeah. Of course, he walked on by, in the words of the immortal bard.
Who walked on by?
Buddha hung with the ascetics, tried the ascetic thing. He was down to one grain of rice a day, according to some stories, and sitting in campfires and, you know, the general notion was if you can switch off your attachments to sense perceptions and physical sensations, that you will experience some kind of mental quietude and you know, space in which something is more luminous is revealed to you. But he tried it and found that it left a residue or a trace of that effort of trying to do something in or get rid of something. So that didn't work for him. I mean, you could say, well, we should try it too. I mean, I'm intrigued by if somebody else has already tried something. Like, you've tried all the drugs I ever need to take. You know what I mean?
Okay, sure, David. David. Like, you've never taken drugs.
Well, of course I have. Yeah.
I know you. I know this. You were in the '60s. I know who you're hanging out with.
Yeah, but my point is that you can learn from other people's experience if you. Like the whole idea of Buddhism, you know, well, it's just one guy in a forest, as you said, 2,500 years ago. So why should you even care anything he said or what he did? Because you have to find out for yourself. But there is some efficacy in hearing other people's stories along the way and learning, benefiting from their experience.
Right. Yeah. Right. You can save some time that way. I just, yeah. the
You have to verify though.
You have to verify. Mm-hmm. But just to stick around in the forest with the ascetics, you know, this is, I like this part of the story of Buddhism, and I like how it's sort of like, at least as far as I'm aware, maybe you can correct me on this, not detailed. There's just this sort of thing. He goes in the forest, he does penances, he gets so thin. There's the emaciated Buddha statue that you see sometimes and is an example of his discipline and all that, but they don't talk. It's like Jesus, when Jesus disappears, it's a similar thing where and this is like in the stories of these avatars, there is inevitably a period. Muhammad goes up into the cave. There's a period where they kind of disappear from society. We don't know what happened. In a lot of cases, I think in Islam, we know that he was visited by angels who gave him the Quran. But with Buddha, same thing. He goes off into the forest. He trains with these people who represent ancient lineages in India that many of them might just be gone forever. So we don't even know if they even exist anymore. But again, if you hear the story, you imagine him maybe just hanging out with people in, I don't know, loincloths and dirty robes or, you know what I mean? But I don't think that's what it was. I think he came into contact with a mystery school, some sort of group perhaps, or some kind of religion or a cult or something in there. And they did teach him stuff. They did, in a way, you could say, open the pathway for Buddhism to exist in the world. Because would he have come to that epiphany if not for the starvation period and the asceticism? So I think one could argue that those ascetics were not quite as unintentional as people might imagine.
Oh yeah. I mean, you can color the story however you want. But the fact is that now you have your choices to make about how to live. And the amount of rivers that come together to inform your options is massive at this point, unprecedented. So the question is, how do you choose how to format your own existence? And all these are just rumors, basically, how somebody else did in the past.
Well, yeah, I know, and it's speculation. The reason I think it is a good form of a good thing to think about, is because. Number one, you're in Buddhism, you are invited to do this form of analysis. And in other words,
that's a big difference, right? You're actually invited to use your discriminating awareness to process whatever somebody's suggesting that you process.
You have to. It's not that you're invited. It's if you're going to do it, you have to. There's no choice. You can't faith your way out of the damn thing, unfortunately. And the reason I think it's cool to think about that period is because to me it implies something that I think is really wonderful, which is in the world, there are anonymous groups of people who are directly responsible for shifting the planetary culture for thousands of years. And no one ever knows who these people are. But the one thing they can erase from the stories, and I think they would if they could, is these periods of time that the great teachers spend in seclusion that aren't detailed at all. It's like they can't get that off the record. They can erase themselves in the sense that no one knows who the names, as far as I'm aware, of the people Buddha was sitting with in the forest who said, why don't you stop eating for a little bit? You know, it's good to cut out habits no matter what they are. Just like what you said to me, that's what they said to him. And he was like, all right, I'll give it a shot. And so all I'm saying is it's cool as a fantasy to imagine that those people haven't really gone anywhere. They're still there in their little spirituality messiah factories. Who knows? You know, sculpting some new Buddha right now that they're going to release into the world. God bless today's sponsor, Athletic Greens, for sending me, finally sending me, a vitamin powder I can use. I'm not a vitamin person. I feel embarrassed when my friends have big, fat Ziploc bags full of vitamins. Ugh, what's going on with you? It's not good for you. I've seen my friends vomit, projectile vomit, fall down on the street, and have mild reactions to the massive amounts of vitamins that they're taking. Aside from all that, I just don't have the discipline to do the thing. What are you gonna in the beginning of the week? What do? Put your vitamins in your medication tin. If I'm taking medication, it's gonna be benzos, baby. When I'm older, I can't take it now because I get addicted. The point is, Athletic Greens makes me feel great. Gives me better gut health, more energy, an optimized immune system, and I don't have to think about it. I don't want to think about it. I just want to put the stuff in my mouth, and then it works. With one delicious scoop of Athletic Greens, you're absorbing 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, whole food source superfoods, probiotics, and adaptogens. What's an adaptogen? I don't know. I do know, though, that it makes me feel good when I take Athletic Greens. Costs you less than $3 a day, plus you're investing in your health, and it's definitely cheaper than coffee or whatever else you like to put in your body. It's cheaper than the supplements, and best of all, you're investing in all-in-one nutritional insurance. Tons of people take some kind of multivitamin, and it's important to choose one with high-quality ingredients that your body will actually absorb. Plus, this subscription comes with a year's supply of vitamin D. This is way more than a year's supply, in my humble opinion, but that probably means I haven't been taking it enough, because this vitamin D they sent me doesn't seem to just as lasting forever. The point is, Athletic Greens is a fantastic company with really cool founders, and I hope you will invest in your health through Athletic Greens. Right now, it's time to reclaim your health and arm your immune system with convenient daily nutrition, especially these days. You know what's going on. It's just one scoop and a cup of water every day. That's it. No need for a million different pills. What are you, the Jimi Hendrix of vitamins? Just take your scoop of Athletic Greens and enjoy life. To make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free one-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and five free travel packs with your first purchase. All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/Duncan. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/Duncan to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance. Thank you, Athletic Greens.
Well, when you do any form of retreat practice, you're mirroring that process to the extent, you know, if you do a weekend or a week or a month. But like somebody like Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, who was Trungpa Rinpoche's, one of his teachers, supposedly had spent 15 years in a cave.
Exactly.
Now, that's
right.
That's old school, you know. Anybody these days, it's going to be a hard thing to orchestrate. I'm sure there are people doing it, actually, by the way, right now. In fact, I know there are. But you know, is that going to be the right orchestration for your life with two kids and a business? And
yes.
And is there some way that you can, is it even possible for you to consider achieving any kind of understanding, depth of realization without doing that? That's a really interesting question.
Yeah. Well, okay. Two answers to that. Number one, and again, this is like a fantasy, but there, like, I think that there is the possibility, and I did a podcast with Lama Somo. Have you ever heard of Lama Somo? She's cool, but she's like, we talked about the four immeasurables in Buddhism, but within the conversation, she was sort of talking about how, and we've had this conversation too, this idea of shared mind. You know, shared mind. And so, or this concept of, you know, being connected to everything, everyone on the planet, everything connected. So in other words, these beings, whoever they may be, I don't even know, maybe they're not even planetary. Who knows? Maybe they are, or they sort of like channel through people sometimes, or who knows? I don't know. It's all speculation.
Well, that's not just totally speculation. For example, there are documentable oracles within the Tibetan Buddhist tradition.
Yeah.
I've actually met the two principal oracles of the Dalai Lama and actually got to talk to them about their process. So there is a pretty definable process in which they vacate the premise of the body. They're not really there. They're sort of nearby, but they're not really there.
Yeah.
And another entity, another discrete form of intelligence actually occupies that situation.
Yes.
And has access to a different field of knowledge. And there's the Nechung Oracle, who's kind of a very ordinary monk and very lovely person, but doesn't claim to be any kind of particular teacher himself. But he does they do a ritual and he is gone. And then Nechung comes into his body, and it's quite, anybody who wants to look at this, you can look it on YouTube. It's just look up Nechung, N-E-C-H-U-N-G, Oracle. And he becomes this other entity, which is kind of startling for anybody who's seen it. And then he speaks an arcane Tibetan language that only certain of the monks can understand. And the Dalai Lama consults with him.
Yeah.
And that's the oracle. That's the person who said to the Dalai Lama, you have to leave Tibet tonight.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so it's not like it's not like horoscopes. Like the data that they get that they give them is very usable and imminent, like he's given him imminent information about things like actions that need to be taken right away. He probably is the reason that Tibetan Buddhism made it to the West is because of that oracle.
Well, and he's still very much alive. There's a monastery in Dharamsala, which is the Nechung Monastery, and that's where he resides. So, and the quality of there's a big O there, and another entity comes through the O.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You know,
there's an opening, and these are people who, for whatever karmic reason, have the capacity to just open themselves. There's another one, which is Kondo Saringma, who's a woman oracle, who she's quite extraordinary, but a very lovely, kind of grounded person. But you can feel that there's operations going on more than one level of the elevator, you know?
Yeah.
It's like the person's elevator's at the ninth floor and the third floor at the same time.
That, right.
And that. And we have that right now.
Yes.
There's multi-dimensional quality, but it depends what we're paying attention to and how obsessed we are with whatever we're trying to get done.
Yes, right. That. See, that to me, that's why the consideration of not just the fundamental, down-to-earth basics of some of the wisdom traditions, but the stuff that's left out, but is clearly like the progenitor of the thing itself, but it gets left out. I mean, that's just to me, that's always that's where things get really curious, is because those are always the smartest people. Like the smartest people are the ones who don't want to be the mascot, who, you know what I mean? Who are like, I don't want to. Okay. So, or another way to put it would be, Brian Eno has a term called genius, the genius of the scene. So like anytime you get a David Bowie, anytime you get an Andy Warhol, anytime you get an Aleister Crowley or any of these people, whether they're, you know, teachers or whatever, there is a whole community behind them that's been cooking up the ideas that they're expressing through their particular mode of communication. And you hear that and you think, ah, wow, well, I guess David Bowie lucked out because he got to be David Bowie. But some of these people who are cooking up the David Bowie, they don't want to be David Bowie. They don't want to be on stage. Right. They don't want to be in front of anything. But they're the ones who are like offering it to the world in the most selfless way.
Well, Duncan, it's like Lenny Bruce, you know?
Yeah, I know Lenny Bruce, but what do you mean?
We are all singing I Have the Mouth.
Yeah, right. That. That. Yeah.
And I think that's, isn't that what you're referring to?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's the, you know, dummies like me who like to have the mouth, but the the like there's
whoa, I'm gonna interrupt here with a K. See, this is the K part.
K.
Why are you saying dummies like me?
Well, but,
why did you say that?
Well, because like I think that the impulse to get it into the spotlight. Mm-hmm. I'm so happy it exists because I love movies. I love movie stars. Right. I love performers. I love art. I was just listening to Miles Davis on the way here.
Right.
So glad that he decided to stand in front of a microphone and make music, because he seems like someone who maybe didn't want to necessarily do that. I'm so glad these people exist. I mean, by that, I mean, like, he seems so, like, weirdly reclusive, or I don't know. When I'm listening to his music, there's a loneliness in it. It's a different podcast. My point is, and I don't want to emphasize this too much, I just think it's cool to contemplate the behind the scene people. You know, behind the scene people are interesting. The like that to me, they're very interesting. Paranoid people tune into this. And they call them the deep state, or they come up with these really crazy conspiracy theories
right.
about these people as being shadowy, dark creatures. But the reason they seem so shadowy and dark, I think, is just because they're like, I don't want to be president. I don't want to be the Buddha. And in fact, I think Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, didn't they have to like, they told him you need to come out of the cave. Like, wasn't he invited out of the cave and he didn't want to leave?
Well, circumstances sometimes transcend one's own intention.
Yeah.
Right?
Right, yeah.
And you, if you have a general, I think what could unite the O and the K is a sense of service for both.
Yes.
And that you go, you know, you almost would say, let me be where it would be most helpful for me to be, in the O realm or the K realm. Or what I think is, you know, there's a lot of art in balancing the O and the K these days, where you have some contemplation, but you also manifest in the world. That's, you know, that's kind of my song.
Yes. And yes. And that's the second answer to your question regarding like the contemplation of these things and the reality. Like most of us, I know of a cave in the forest, but I sure as fuck wouldn't sit there. There's broken glass all over it. It's slimy. So I'm not going to a cave. Most people listening to this probably are not going to go sit in a cave for 20 years. And this,
but you could go to your meditation cushion for 20 minutes,
and it'll feel like 20 years.
Maybe it actually is 20 years.
Yeah,
you know, depending.
Yeah, right. I mean, this is to me the too much fixation on the cave stuff and the that part of it can accidentally create a weird sense of guilt. You know, I think some people have a family. They are fully in service to their family. Yeah. They wake up with their kids. They put the kids to bed. By then they're so tired, they fall asleep. They're going to work to feed the kids. They're engaged in this like purely selfless activity that I think for some parents, it's incredibly pure. And even if it isn't incredibly pure, the base of it is this selfless activity.
Sure.
That is no different than the going away down from the cave like Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche did, or that is no different from any of the great servants of the world. But because, you know, I think we live in a culture where the centralization is celebrated, that we like love to focus on the apex of things. This is why there's the Olympics and football and all that. That accidentally, a lot of people just at their home serving their kids, they feel like, but I'm not up in a cave like I should be.
If you took that parent and that parent did some practice for 20 or 30 minutes a day, that's a powerful cocktail.
Yeah, the combo of
combo. One from column A and one from column B.
Yeah.
You know, seriously, I think it's overlooked how transformative and how potentially good for the whole system and the whole gang of us would be that kind of balance of O and K, or, you know, deep contemplation and actually skillful action as part of the same equation.
Well,
I'm totally committed, you could say, to that equation.
The at our home, at my house, I came home. My brother-in-law's there. He and Aaron are watching like Fox News, which we have managed to cut out mostly, but I sat down to watch it a little bit. They're watching it because they couldn't find the remote control. So, you know, you're sitting there just, you know, talk about the oracle, right? Like the reason that Dalai Lama's oracle seems spectacular or is interesting is because it's a human channeling a being. If the Dalai Lama had a special radio that tuned into a radio station somewhere else in Tibet where there was a monk who just told him what to do, it would be cool, but it wouldn't be as interesting, right? So in other words, everyone at their own home has oracular devices. It's not a person, but you flip on the hypno rectangle and you can channel the howl of misery, suffering, violence, fear, and anger in the world right into your house and fill it with the perfume of fear and get it into your body. And so I'm just backing up what you're saying, which is if there is this possibility of slowing down, getting still. And it's not just a one-way street, but in that practice, you're opening up a little bit to something bigger, then you are going to you're going to bring not just your own self into the house, but you're going to bring with you just that, whatever that is, whatever that is. And that, I think, is, that's what, I mean, that to me is the, you've told me a little bit about the, what are they called? Dralas, I think. Is that
Drala,
what? Yeah. Can you describe that again? Like the house Drala or the...
So Drala is just the notion, well, the literal meaning is beyond aggression.
Okay.
So La is above, you know, like Lhasa or Lama, it means above, and Dra, it means war or aggression. So what kind of energy field is there beyond aggression? It has a kind of uplifted... fragrant, light quality of energy. You know,
it's
you can feel it in certain spots, power spots in nature. You can feel Drala energy.
Yeah.
The home has Drala spots in it. People have Drala. You know, so it's a sort of a general form of understanding the sparkly energy that comes when you stop struggling and fighting so much.
Okay, so
it's natural energy, and you can tap into it. That's the idea. Is there's particular dralas you can tune into with certain rituals and things like that.
Whoa! Oh wow! Like what rituals?
Well, like there's one cedar smoke, and you raise smoke, and then they come down on the smoke. It's, you know, it's a way of organizing. Rituals, a way of organizing people into a kind of process in which these things. You know, you clear away the deck so that you can invite the dralas in. But there's a corollary to it, which is called wind horse, which is a sense of raising one's own energy level. So when you raise wind horse, and you know, you can just visualize what a wind horse looks like. It's a powerful, uplifted, kind of confident kind of energy. When you rouse that in yourself, because it's there, it's resting, nesting in you, but it's stifled by your doubt, and it's stifled by your hyper-discursiveness, and it's stifled by your fear. But when you raise that energy, the dralas are magnetized and they come. So, you know, it's a way of talking about rousing confidence and you know, your own energetic field. And then it meets the world in a more magical way and a very spontaneous way.
I want to thank my beautiful sponsors over at Squarespace.com. I can't tell you how many times a month people ask, how do you do a podcast? And I tell them, well, you need a few essential things. Number one, a quiet podcast studio, somewhere where you won't be interrupted by lots of noise. Number two, you need a place where your podcast can live online, and that is where Squarespace comes in. It's a one-stop shop. They've got everything you need if you want to create an online home from your podcast, from exclusive member-only areas. If you want to put some of your stuff behind a paywall, they've got it. If you want to do email campaigns, send out emails to your listeners, they've got that. They've got really fantastic analytics, and most importantly, they're easy to use. have mix and match templates so you can have a podcast website up in less than an hour. They're amazing. The proof is in the pudding. Head over to DuncanTrussell.com and lay your beautiful eyes on a website that Barack Obama called the pulsing digital heart of America. Thank you, Barack. If you're interested in Squarespace, head over to squarespace.com/Duncan and try them out for free. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code Duncan. You're going to get 10% off your first order of a website or a domain. Again, squarespace.com/Duncan. Give it a shot. And then use offer code Duncan and you'll get 10% off of your first order of a website or a domain. Thank you, Squarespace. Like the way rainbows appear, like you, if you have the right conditions, sprinkler, sun.
Right, that's right.
You make a rainbow appear. It's not complex. You can do it, but it's always incredible. And so that's kind of like what you're like the Drawla. It's like a rainbow that appears when the right conditions are in a certain place. Suddenly you're like, holy shit, what is this? Things do. You know, I have noticed sometimes just not like we'll be playing music and the kids are like, I made them breakfast and everyone's eating and like smiling and laughing and it's good. And then this other thing comes in all of a sudden, you know, it is us, but there's something more than us. And then things get really luminous or like there's a quality that's incredible. And you know, whenever that appears, I notice it. And then I want to like, how do we make this out? How do we make the house like this forever? Yeah. I want it always to be like this.
Yeah, there's a lot of letting go involved.
Right.
You create the right circumstances, you magnetize that kind of energy, and then you have to let go as a sort of an important part of the process too. But there's dramas in all kinds of cultures. More in the pantheistic cultures, polytheistic cultures, because they don't rivet so hard and there's just one big thing and it's all a blob of, you know, all or nothing kind of approach to spirituality. So every like Greek culture had Drawla like energies, early Etruscan cultures. You can see them. They have names for them and everything like that.
So right? We aren't in our culture, you even coming close to talking about it, you have to replace it. Like it's not raising wind horse. It's not contacting some sort of divine energy. It's like getting confident and keep your house clean. And
that's right. That if you're manifesting some kind of dignity and, you know, kind of steadiness of mind, clarity and stability of mind, that is energizing and magnetizing to the Drawlas. If you're, you know, coarse and out of control and kind of out of sequence within yourself and struggling, they were repelled by that. Right. So there was a very interesting thing that I back in the day, I was at a house in Boston where Trungpa Rinpoche used to stay, and there was a calligraphy there. And I asked somebody what it meant. It was Tibetan. And they said, and this was when he first came to the West, like in 1970, the calligraphy said, "Adult bodies, children's minds."
Wow.
That was his take on the West. And then there was a quote from one of his Dharma brothers, Trungpa Rinpoche, who was a very great Lama. And Trungpa Rinpoche said that Trungpa Rinpoche, when he came here, he saw that the Drawlas had been scared away in America by things like strip mining and just the general lack of regard for the environment and also how people are taking care of themselves. And he said that he instituted a number of practices and rituals that would invite them back.
Like what?
Well, like raising wind horse, and also there are certain sadhana practices where you can tune in. It's like tuning into a frequency. You know, if you and I are sitting together and we go, let's listen to Love Supreme, John Coltrane, we're tuning into that frequency.
Right.
If we watch porn, we're tuning into that frequency.
What if you listen to John Coltrane and watch porn simultaneously?
And meditate at the same time?
Yeah. Now you've invented a religion. Now you've started a cult.
I don't know. I think it's all been done. But lurking beneath what you're saying is it possible to enjoy sense pleasures, going back to the ascetic discussion?
Yeah.
And do that in a non-degraded way, that in a way that doesn't make you unhappy, basically, fundamentally. And definitely in Tantric Buddhism, you have to do that. You're supposed to relate to the realm of the senses.
Yeah, right.
You can't boycott it.
But what, you know, I think why do sense pleasures so often make you unhappy?
Yeah, it depends. I think even if you examine your own reality, you would come up with the answer that it depends. Because have you had a nice cup of coffee this morning?
Oh, absolutely. But yeah, I'm talking about like the, I just think an easy mistake you can make. I love the description of the skandhas. And mm-hmm. I believe the initial skandha was described, and maybe it's the second one. I don't even know the name of the skandhas, but this is the way that the self kind of forms into time, I guess. And
right.
So one of the descriptions is like a pig rooting around for food is like, that's the initial skandha, right? You're sort of, you have some separation, some sense of a thing in the first
sense of duality, but it's quite vague in the beginning.
Yes. And so you're like right. snorting around looking for something. Right. And so maybe you found something that was like at some point in your life, as we call it chasing the dragon, you know, instead of like chasing the drala, chasing the dragon, right? You find a thing. Oh my God, right. That's really nice. Like anyone who's ever been addicted to a drug knows what I'm talking about. You like, you know what I mean? You find this thing and it's like, oh my God, I've been looking for this my whole life. This experience is amazing. Wow, I'm connecting with the universe. And then cut to like 6 months later.
Cut to,
And it's like nothing's happening anymore. It's gone from being transcendent and beautiful, which I think is the tantric invitation, to being worse than a
course.
Course and pointless and embarrassing. And you're like, what am I even doing this for? So it is, I think, interesting to note that a lot of the ways people think that you're going to get that big burst of whatever, it's not working for you at all. And you've been trying over and over again with no success.
As you said, cut to, you know, which is, we know what we mean there. But that's what contemplation is. In contemplation practice, you cut to, you look analytically at the outcome that you know is from time immemorial has led to a certain causes have led to certain effects.
Right.
So therefore, through the power of, really applying your intelligence to it, you have enough strength to say, I think I'll take a pass on this at this point.
Right. Right. Yes.
But then you have to marry that to some kind of practice, because otherwise the contemplation, you see clearly that it's not, you know, like, for example, that eating buckets of sugar is not great for you.
Right.
But your body is tuned into it and you can't cut the habit. So you need both the analytical and the sort of rehabituation part.
Right.
To achieve good habits, you know, and there's such a good thing as good habits, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, right. Sure. I mean, this is why, you know, for me, this is why having a family has just been the most enlightening experience, in the sense that you hear all the service bullshit and the like, you know, become a servant or help other people or the meta nonsense. You know what I mean? And if you at least if you're like me, you're like, all right, I don't know, sounds good, whatever. But then when you have a family, you really, there is a binary, which is like, you can either be selfish or not. Right. And except when you're the consequence of selfishness in a family versus the consequence of selfishness when you're living by yourself.
Yeah.
You can't, your dog's going to seem like grumpy or something because you're not petting them all the time versus like your kid, you know, you seeing in your kids, like the way your karma is sort of radiating into their lives and imprinting on them. It's a whole different type of mirror, you know? And then also when you just, the most basic stuff, you know, putting them to bed, making them food, becomes the most transcendent experience, you know?
And this is where I, from watching the other day, I think it is true. And, you know, we Buddhists can be very analytical and kind of intellectual. But I feel, especially at this point, that if you center in your heart and you drop your energy literally physically into your heart center, you have a very a different access point for doing the right thing.
Yes.
And a lot of times people's energy lifts up with wind and it goes into their heads.
Yes.
And moves around kind of quickly in the head. And it's harder to find the natural thing to do, the organic thing to do. So that's why stillness, you know, just dropping into the heart center and simplifying, I think is the essence of everything we've been talking about for years, you know.
Yeah.
Just slowing down. Oh, okay. Everybody slow down. Can you imagine that if people had to meditate before they bombed each other?
I think, sadly, I think some people probably do.
Oh, God, that's a horrible thought.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I know, but I do think probably it like gets people's like minds focused enough to be able to, you know, I don't think meditation keeps you from, I don't believe the idea that if everyone meditates, you still, we all have this dream that it's the classic, like anyone who's taken acid is like, if only we could get this.
Sure. Imagine
the every president taking acid or whatever it may be. And that is a really, I think, naive assessment of, you know, how, like, I don't think it necessarily is going to cure the world's problems. And then, of course, I've heard that, you know, a lot of people in the military are practice mindfulness and have been taught mindfulness practices.
In the Russian military?
I would not be surprised. I mean, because, okay.
Well, they did have science experiments going on for sure about, you know, remote location and things like that, for sure. But I'm not talking about meditating and sort of orchestrating your mental activity. I'm talking about feeling. And I think that's when people go a little deeper into meditation, they realize it's not just folding the sheets up in your brain, you know, and color coding the underwear of your brain so that it's all organized and neat. It's what happens if you just touch in and look and feel. You think they're doing that?
I don't think all of them are, but I do. I think in some warrior traditions, actually, you kill with love. Like when you're killing in your heart. Like you're in your heart. It's the most honorable way to kill, is to kill from that place. Like you, instead of killing from your head and being all numb, you have such a respect for the person that you're killing that as you're killing them, you're seeing them as you, and you're loving them and doing it. And
that's not what's happening though, Duncan. What's happening is being driven by speed, aggression, and greed. Ignorance, 99.9%, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, yes, absolutely, I do. I think like most of the time what you're seeing is people doing something that if they don't do it, they're going to get arrested. You know, we did it. The United States did it. We took a bunch of kids and threw them in the fucking jungle in Vietnam, forced them to go there. They, you know, we like, which to me, I mean, you know, I think you see right now people who are saying in the United States, you really don't have a right to say anything about the fucking what's going on in Ukraine because your country has been doing this shit over and over and over and over again. And for the anyone in the United States to take issue with what Putin is doing is the height of hypocrisy. I think it's the stupidest take because I've been to the peace marches. I've been to the, like, when we tried to stop the war machine. And they don't listen to us any more than the people who are trying to stop it in Russia being listened to. Meaning that you are allowed anytime wars spring up because of aggression and greed to be like, this is horrible. Don't do this. Stop doing this.
Right.
You know what I mean? You, no matter what country you're in, whether you're in Russia, the United States, the Ukraine. And also you're allowed to recognize like how fucked up it is that a lot of these Russian kids, they didn't know they were going to war. And so they're just cannon fodder. And these are all people. So I think you can kind of have a universal sense of compassion for all sides involved. And I'm not suggesting that like all of them are meditating and stuff. I just know Putin like is a martial artist, studies judo, and
I know. I mean, you know, I've had that conversation, and here's a kind of caveat around it. mindfulness alone, you know, the focus point of meditation. See, a lot of people have thought meditation just means you focus your mind and control, learn how to control your mind. That is very primitive approach towards meditating, if I could say so. It is foundational because if you don't have any concentration, it's hard to cultivate anything, right? It's hard to cultivate judo or anything.
Yeah.
But mindfulness alone could make you a perfect assassin.
Yes, exactly.
I've said that many times. But if you add vipassana to it, if you add loving kindness to it, if you add some kind of compassion practice to it on that foundation, that begins to destabilize that sort of colorless quality of mindfulness and the kind of purely functional part that is so popular in the West. Look at the ads. Oh, this is going to make you calm. This is going to make you stable. It's going to make you efficient. It's going to make you productive. You know, that's a very early, stage in the Buddhist path of practice. It's just laying a foundation. It's not a house that you want to live in.
No, I know. But this is why Trungpa Rinpoche was like, had all this cautionary stuff in his teachings, because he knew he could tell right away what we are like. He saw what we are like. And
adult bodies, children's minds.
Yeah, adult bodies, children's minds. But I think he also saw something else in us that was probably for him, which is why when I've seen him speaking at lectures, there's just this lonely quality to him. Not a neurotic loneliness, but like I'm on another fucking planet here. You know what I mean? Like I'm like, he's wearing our clothes and he's trying to like use our language to communicate these ideas. But I just think he was like, oh my God, if I don't, this could just as easily turn into something people use for, there weren't even drones back then or drone pilots back then, but he grokked. This is something that if people decide to stop at the part you're talking about,
right,
then now what have you done except created like sociopaths if they want to be, because you can hear we're all the same person or we're all completely connected. We are, when you see another person, that's just you. Literally Tong Lin, right? Becoming another. That's what Tong Lin means, right? Like,
well, not exactly. Not exactly. It means exchanging your sense of self-absorption with attention and care for others, like swapping. It doesn't mean you become the other person.
Right.
But you're willing to take on some aspect of them that makes you less comfortable.
Okay.
You're willing to give out something. It means sending and taking, literally.
Sending and receiving.
Yeah. So what are you sending? You're sending out your own, you know, kind of positive feelings about wanting to do well and to be healthy and to thrive. You're sending that to the other person, and what are you taking in is their sense of discomfort, which usually makes you want to avoid them. And you're saying, "No, I'm not going to avoid them. I'm going to take it in." And that's like Tong Lin, for example, is a powerful transformative practice. That's not like just becoming a. You could not become an assassin and do that. Actually, it would stop you from being an assassin.
Right. I mean, there's a. I think it's Tolstoy wrote this wonderful book called The Kingdom of Heaven is Within. Have you ever heard of this book?
But I haven't read it.
Well, the book is like a profoundly anti-war essay stating that you cannot be a Christian and a soldier. You can't do it. You can't.
Onward Christian soldiers.
Yeah, exactly. That old thing, onward Christian soldiers, the Crusades. All of it is an example of, I guess, the rather obvious point I'm making, which is religion can be warped in ways that turn it into the most horrible, violent, insane thing. And Buddhism is no different. Like, you can, from a muddied comprehension of it, just as easily decide that there's really, like, no point. You can go nihilist. I'm just saying, from a muddy.
Oh, it could be worse than nihilism. It could be imperialism.
Right.
Which is actually worse than nihilism.
Explain that to me. Why is that?
Well, you feel like you have, divined a superior perspective.
Yes.
You know, a superior point of view. And from that point of view, for the benefit of beings, I'm going to impose that point of view through manipulation, cleverness,
magic,
seduction. Whatever, but it's the fundamental self-deception has gone unexamined.
Right. That's why it's so dangerous.
Why, like in our teacher training program that we have at Dharma Moon, we always have self-assessment as the ground practice, because there's no other way. Yeah. I could tell you whatever, but you know, somebody else could say, Duncan, what do you, but unless you would look at yourself and want to know, or I would look at myself and want to know, probably none of these processes can, and that's why Buddhism's not theistic. Nobody can save you.
Right.
That's a big difference. A lot of religions say somebody could save you if you only just drop your trowel low enough and, or you know, surrendered or whatever. This energy is going to come in, it's going to save you, but Buddhists don't say that.
Right.
And if you do give somebody that power, you're kind of not, you're missing the point.
Right. Yeah. And that maybe that is the danger of Buddhism, is that in that saving yourself, an accidental egomaniac can spring up, right? That's the problem. You can, I'm doing this myself, pulling myself up on my fucking bootstraps. I don't need anybody else. Right. No one saved me. I saved myself. You have to save yourself because
that's right.
I'm not going to
fucking
help you.
But it's nihilism. That's nihilism. Oh,
yeah.
That is the nihilistic one. And the other one is that some you don't have to do diddly squat, but you know, just open to grace or surrender to whatever, and somebody else is going to save you. That's eternalism. So you know, this is a tricky thing about the Buddhist practice, is that you don't ally with extremes if you can identify them.
Right.
It's non-extremism. It's kind of moderation in a way.
Right. Yeah.
And moderation is a good intersocial practice. Like if you and I are talking, we don't agree, it's good if we be more moderate and try to understand the other person better. It's healthy.
But let's go back to the K part, though. Like
we got there right away with that.
You know, because that is the that there is that quality in Buddhism as well, though. I mean, it is a, you know, there is it is. The fucking Mongols were Buddhists, many of them. Mm-hmm, they started the Genghis Khan. Would Tibetan Buddhism exist without Genghis Khan?
Well, that's not a multiple choice question or a yes or no question. But yes, there's no doubt at all that and let me just frame this out a different way. What we would call neurosis or confusion, there is no way enlightenment would exist without it.
Right. Yeah, okay.
So exactly. That's a broader stroke. Now, so what do you do with, I think there's a different levels of how to work with it. One is definitely abandon poison fruit, you know, ground up. If you know something's bad for you or bad for your family, or just stop doing it, period, over and out, if you can. But then there's the idea of transforming it, seeing its essence as maybe there's a confusion built into it that could be a knot that could be untied.
Right.
And then it's just energy. You know, like for example, when people are having a good debate, you could say, oh, they're fighting with each other, but they're not actually.
Right.
Because they haven't stopped communicating.
Right.
At the point where they stop communicating, they start fighting.
That's where there's real trouble.
It is, and everything gets tight, and you can feel it. You know, you feel like, and passion is the same thing, right? When you get tightened up with your passion, it stops flowing between two people, becomes, you know, a constricted experience. So the O thing is really important.
Right. Yeah.
You got to O.
Both. Yeah, both. Yeah. There's something where, there's just something I've been thinking lately, and it's, and I just can't get it out of my head, which is, there's a certain sort of person in the world that could destroy the world. I mean, it's every person, but there's a certain sort of person specifically that can get into a place of power and then cause incredible amounts of suffering from getting into that place of power. There's a personality type, you know, that it's, we're seeing it play out now.
Jealous gods.
The jealous gods. Yeah, the jealous gods. And because so we know this. People know this. We're aware of it, right? Like people know, and again, I'm not, I'm saying any of them, Putin, Biden, Trump, Obama, any of these dudes who find themselves in the position, who have put themselves in the position with lots of energy, gotten into a position where they have control of nuclear missiles, right? any of them are a danger to the planet. They're not helping at all.
I don't mean to interrupt, but is that fundamentally different than, for example, a domestic fight between a husband and a wife? And let's say you had a little red button that you could push and your wife would blow up.
Yeah, right.
Would your finger not be hovering over that sometimes?
Well, no. I mean, everyone has that. This is like everyone has in their stupid domestic arsenal, like the thing that you pull out that's the big mean thing. And then they'll pull out a meaner thing. And then you have a stupid nuclear war fight that you have to go to marriage counseling to repair the radiation from it. You know what I mean? So, yes, I know what you mean. Exactly. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, it's in all of us.
Yeah.
But
who are these people and how did they get so powerful over the whole situation? And is there a way to defang it? It's like poison. Is there a way to defang it? That's really a great question, actually.
That's, to me, I think that's, you know, even more imminent than, I guess you could say they're interconnected, really, because a lot of these people happen to be connected to oil. But more intimate than dealing with the climate stuff is recognizing, wait a minute, we have created a system that is up, pushing up to the very top of, or the front of the bus, the craziest among us. Mm-hmm. And once they get control of the bus, it doesn't matter if they've been like, let me drive, y'all are a little drunk. Where do you want to go? Don't worry, I'll take you where you want to go.
Sure.
Pretty soon, it's like, wait, we said right. And they're like, yeah, we're going to do a little fucking detour because I'm driving the bus. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so I'm just saying, this.
I still think, though, that's basic ego is who's doing that.
Right.
And you're just on a very large scale with it at the moment.
Yes.
But that exact dynamic is at work in every situation that I experience during the day.
Right. Yeah.
I thought we were going over here. No, we're going this way. And so I'm not saying this is a glib answer and a kind of new agey kind of answer to what do you do with global titans who are every day we're watching the horror show I've been, really upset lately. I'm sure everybody's been upset just watching. How could somebody do that? How could somebody say, send tanks into this relatively peaceful place and just start blowing the shit out of everybody?
Yeah.
And what logic how inured do you have to be to human suffering to even, and then create a whole set of propaganda and lies around that? What's going on with that person? What the hell, man?
Right. Well, I think I know what's going on with those people. I don't know if you ever went hunting as a kid, but you have to learn how to kill animals. You know what I mean? You don't want to do it. You have to learn to do it.
Mm.
And then you can do it. And so I think it's just the exact same thing, but with people for them, they don't really think there's a humanist. There's a lot of idealism in people like us but in that there's this weird assumption that, well, at the heart of everyone is this, but maybe not.
The thing you might be onto there, and it's, is the predator prey model.
Yeah.
Which you're going to be.
Right. That,
if you talk to certain warriors, they're really tuned into that model.
Yeah.
Look, it's me or that one. And if you're going to be one or the other, be the predator. So I know some very intelligent people who would argue that point of view, but a bodhisattva would not argue that point of view.
Right. I'm not saying that we should argue that there's only one choice or the other. I'm just saying...
Well, wait a minute, though. We should make sure we didn't overlook the possibility that there's something to it.
I do think that it's safe to acknowledge that there are some very mentally ill people who have managed to work their way into political systems that don't belong there. And that this is one of the grand flaws of democracy is that it is the flaw of whatever is inside tribalist, the idea of it. We need a chief, we need a head, we need the top, we need a daddy. You know what I mean? I think we need a guru. We need a blah, 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 or this or that, or someone to save us. We need in this idea of needing someone to save you, that is the fertile ground for dictators, right?
Well, for the predator-prey model to really achieve full full force.
Exactly.
So here's another thought. It's like, if you go into that model and you say, well, we as people, we the people are the prey right now. So maybe we need to learn about being more of a predator.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean,
and that's the K part.
Yeah.
Right. How do you get into the machinery and kind of create some kind of more positive attitude towards leadership?
And I, you know what I think the answer to that is it's just what you were saying earlier. It's like, look, you, especially if you're in the United States, what are you going to do? Go to Russia and like run to be the new Putin? Like, stop. You're not doing anything. But I do know when I'm being Putin in my own house, you know what I mean? It's like all these world peace, all these people yapping about world peace. It's like, have you been able to achieve any kind of harmony in your family or your own domestic situation?
Sure.
Because if you're finding that you can't do it there, then forget we're all fucked. You know what I mean? Then no one can do it. If you can,
that brings it right back, Duncan, to, you know, small.
Yes.
Conquering through the small, like it says in the I Ching, you know, taming through the small. And if you at least preserve the hegemony of your own little domestic kingdom and your own world and improve your relationship to it through practice, through study, through, learning about compassion and learning about, what tools you have available to even pull that much off, I think it does have a ripple effect. I take that view that it ripples. Some people might say it's useless because it's too small.
No, it ripples. It does ripple. I don't think it necessarily ripples in the way a lot of us would want to imagine it's going to ripple. But I do think that no matter what, it's still great. I mean, no matter what, it's, you know, great. If we all hit a certain frequency, then the whole planet turns into Shambhala, vibrates out of this part of the time-space continuum and appears in a paradise world or whatever. Great. I don't think that's going to happen. Or if things become increasingly chaotic, you are going to be one of the people who helps. You know, you don't know how you're going to help or what it's going to look like, but if you're training up now, you know, and then, because that's who I would want to be if I had to be something. I wouldn't want to be the person dropping the bombs. You know, I would.
Well, you know what it might come to, though, is when you saw that loneliness factor, when you saw Trungpa Rinpoche, and you saw he looks very lonely, alone. That's a real quality of warriorship, the way we learned it. You have to be willing to be alone.
Yeah.
In a very, very deep way. And that means, nobody's going to confirm or deny your perspective.
Yeah.
It means you're not going to get a medal.
Yeah.
It means maybe nobody even knew that you existed or did it.
Yeah.
But you still have a feeling of like, I'm going to do this the right way. I'm going to do the right thing. But that's a very personal level of integrity. And then, I think you can cultivate and train in that perspective. I do.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. Yeah, because
I didn't mean you personally. I meant one can.
But that's why I mentioned this stuff earlier, because I think there's something really quite, and again, it's just creating a romantic reason to meditate and stuff. But I do think, like, if you imagine that we are all Christian soldiers. No, but if you do imagine that there is like, is the O and the K, and there is conflict, and that there is a sort of like an interesting put back and forth, a conversation, I guess you could say, happening between a very like two seemingly opposite ways of living in the world, then you can immediately join up but like what you're saying is you're not going to meet, you probably won't meet the generals, you probably won't meet any sergeants, lieutenants. No one's coming out of a cave to give you a jewel that is magical because you decided to join the part of the world that's trying to cultivate compassion or whatever. And the reason for that, aside from probably there aren't people living in caves who are going to give you jewels, but the bigger reason would be strategically, an army that has no commanders, no king, no visible upper echelon doing the plans, but is just completely decentralized and yet fully in the world and present is undefeatable. There is no way to stop it. You can't use any of the techniques that work if you're on the other side, which is on that side of things, the conversation is, oh, I'll just blow it up, poison it, kill it, you know? But you, who are you going to capture? Who's out there? There isn't anyone other than this basic intent, right? A basic, undefeatable intent, which if you tune into that, that is signing up for something, I think. I love a medal, though.
Well, that's the phenomenal world. You can have it. Why not?
A medal?
Sure. Why not?
Right. Medals are dumb anyway. Like,
well, just, you know, you can dress up the world. That's, you know, when we've talked about it a number of times on our conversations, but absolute and relative truth. The word for relative truth, which is kunsap, means all dressed up.
Kunsap.
K-U-N-D-Z-O-P.
Kunsap.
It literally means you put on the outfit. You put on your vest. You take your canteen. You go for a walk in the woods. You buy your hunting cap. You know, you subscribe to magazines, you know, but you don't confuse it with some kind of definitive level of reality. It's just a relative situation.
Kunsap.
Yeah, and so you work, but you do work with it. If you don't engage kunsap, that's some people, and that goes back to the Buddha. Those people were not engaging kunsap. They didn't have a good sense of relative reality. They were going for absolute truth,
right?
And that's considered the imbalanced from a certain perspective,
right?
So if you can keep both levels braided, that would be a very powerful way to live.
Braided is what they say.
I'm saying it.
Ah, that's so cool. Yeah,
they say inseparable, and absolute and relative truth are inseparable. But braided is the way, you know, to think about it. So, and it's O and K. You know, you have your mantra.
David, these are talks. I just love chatting with you. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I just really love talking to you. Thank you.
Yeah, it's you know, I have a kind of rule talking to you, Duncan, which is that we always start from zero and end at zero.
I know. I almost ruined it too, because I had a couple of serious questions I was going to ask you, and then I realized, don't do that. Like, let's just talk and see what happens. I'm so glad I did that instead.
Yeah.
David, can you tell people a little bit about what's coming up with Dharma Moon and ways they can connect with you?
Yeah, there's such a sweet magic between Dharma Moon and Duncan Trussell. It's really notable that, you know, some of your friends come and take our trainings and then re-enter your ecosystem. And they're such good people, Duncan. It's so honest what's going on there. And it's, you know, we're not conquering the world or changing anything, but we are teaching people how to work with their own state of mind and be a little more gentle and compassionate with themselves and more precise. So that the main form that crystallizes into is this teacher training program that, you know, a lot of the folks have taken. And we have one coming up starting May 18th. So if you just go to dharmamoon.com, you can log in there. And the first weekend of it is, if you're not ready to sign up for the whole thing, you can just take the first part of it. And we're doing it not on weekends in the summer. You know why?
Why?
I think people want their weekends back this summer.
Yes.
I don't want to steal their weekend on front of a computer. So we're doing it Wednesday and Thursday mornings.
Wow. Okay, cool.
And also it's set up so that in European time, we have a lot of people starting to come in from Europe. So it'll be like 4 or 5 o'clock European time.
But if folks are working, how can they can't participate?
Well, nobody works that way anymore.
Okay.
We'll see, but it's 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern time, which is 7 a.m. to 10 p.m.
Okay.
West Coast time. So, okay, you did that before you went to work.
Yeah.
Or you took them a couple of mornings off. And then in Europe, it's, you know, 4 or 5 o'clock. So you finish your work day and you end a little bit early and you still have your evening with your family and friends and you have your weekends free in the summer.
Love it.
So we're it's all indicated in the, if you go to dharmamoon.com and maybe we can put it into the chat, into the, you know, written thing. So I'd love to just continue the grand tradition of the Dunkites invading Dharma Moon and then sending them back with a little training.
I love it.
So please, everybody, just check us out, and if you have any questions, it's easy to write in, and there's payment plans and scholarships. We're trying to make it easy for people to do this.
Thank you so much, David. All the links, if you can't remember, dharmamoon.com will be at duncantrussell.com. Thank you, David. I really appreciate it.
And I feel like I just ate a plum.
Yeah, me too.
You know, Duncan, you're really a sweet person.
Thank you.
I know that you get pissed off at times and so forth, but I think your heart is really good, Duncan.
Thank you, David. You're the best. Hare Krishna, thank you. That was David Nichtern, everybody. Take his class. Go to dharmamoon.com. You'll find all the Nichtern-related stuff you need. Much thanks to our wonderful sponsors, Squarespace, Super Speciosa, and Athletic Greens. And thank you for listening. Come summon drawlers with me in Austin or wherever I'm going. All those dates are at DuncanTrussell.com. I love y'all so much, and I'll see you next week.